All right, so, for all you law students out there, you're probably drowning in case law right now, right? Trying to figure out how all this theory actually plays out in the real world.
Oh, absolutely.
So let's just dive right into a case that really brings some of these big concepts to life, especially when we're talking about some heavy stuff like capital punishment, a defendant's mental state, and just how crucial it is to get those jury instructions exactly right.
Yeah, no, that's a good one.
The People v. Michael James Huggins.
I like it.
It went all the way up to the California Supreme Court, and it really highlights some of those core legal issues that you're probably wrestling with in your classes right now.
Oh, for sure. This case, it's not just your average criminal conviction, you know?
Yeah.
What's really interesting is how it kind of brings together all these fundamental principles. You're learning about criminal procedure, the whole idea of mens rea, you know, the guilty mind. It's like all these legal pressure points just colliding in one case, and then they argue it all the way up to the highest court in the state.
So, okay, let's break it down a little, right? We're talking murder, burglary, robbery.
Huggins was convicted of some pretty serious stuff.
Definitely some heavy charges.
But what really pushed it into capital punishment territory, what made this a death penalty case, were those special circumstances, right?
Yep.
The jury found that the murder happened during the burglary, the robbery, and this is really intense. They also found it happened during a rape or an attempted rape. And then on top of that, you've got enhancements for using a firearm, causing serious bodily injury, and oh, did I mention prior felony convictions?
Yeah, it all paints a pretty a pretty stark picture.
And the way this case moved through the courts, that's a whole story in itself. I mean, think about it. During the first penalty phase, the jury couldn't agree on a sentence.
Hung jury, right?
Yeah, they were totally split, same evidence, same arguments, but two totally different possible outcomes. It really shows you just how heavy these decisions are, how carefully they have to look at everything.
Absolutely, there's a lot of weight on those decisions. And eventually, they had a second penalty phase, they handed down a death sentence, and that automatically triggers an appeal to the California Supreme Court, which is where it all landed.
Right, yeah, that's the process.
So, for our deep dive today, we really want to get into the nitty-gritty of this case. What were the legal battles all about? How did the court reach its decisions? And most importantly, what are the takeaways, the lessons that you, as law students, can learn from this, not just about this case, but about the bigger legal principles at play, the stuff you'll actually use in your careers?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's the goal here.
Let's start with something that's really fundamental to any trial, the defendant's competency.
Okay, yeah, competency to stand trial.
Can the defendant actually understand what's going on?
Yeah.
Can they work with their lawyer to build a defense? I mean, that's kind of the baseline, right?
Yeah, our whole legal system, it assumes that the person on trial, the defendant, can understand the charges against them and they can rationally help their lawyer, you know? So it's like this basic fairness thing.
Right.
And in the Huggins case, there were questions about whether he even met that basic standard. And that's before they even started talking about guilt or innocence. So that triggered a whole separate trial just to figure out if he was competent to stand trial.
Probably before the trial.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
I'm guessing that competency trial, there was some back and forth between the experts, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you always have that in these situations. Some experts thought maybe Huggins was exaggerating his symptoms or maybe even faking them.
Wow.
But, you know, for us, for what we're talking about today, the really interesting part is what happened with the instructions they gave to the jury during that competency phase.
Yeah, the jury instructions.
Yeah, and this is where things get kind of dicey. The judge, the trial court, used the word likely when they were explaining to the jury what Huggins needed to be able to do, like how likely it was that he could understand the trial and help his lawyer. And the defense lawyers, they jumped on that. They said, whoa, 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 that's not the right standard. They argued it should have been substantial certainty, which is a much higher bar to
Well,
clear.
it's a much higher bar.
You know what? The California Supreme Court, the majority of them, they said in the end that difference in the wording, it didn't really change the outcome. But, and this is a big but, the dissenting justices, they totally disagreed.
Okay, so I get why lawyers would care about one word versus another, but for everyone else,
Yeah.
why does it matter so much whether they used likely or substantial certainty? Seems like splitting hairs.
I know, right? It might sound like a tiny detail, but think about it. When you're talking about jury instructions, Every single word matters because the jury is using those instructions to figure out the law, to apply it to the case. Justice Kennard, she wrote this really powerful dissent, and she argued that using likely could have made it easier for the jury to find Huggins competent, even if they had some serious doubts about whether he really grasped everything that was going on, whether he could actually help his lawyer build a defense. And she was worried that, you know, maybe they focused on the wrong things, like how much he was cooperating, instead of whether he really understood the charges against him.
And she was worried that that one word, likely, might have tipped the scales in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and then there was another thing. She pointed out that the written transcript of what the judge said to the jury, it didn't include something really important about whether Huggins could help his lawyer in a rational way, not just help in general. And she was like, hold on, if the jury didn't hear that part, that's a huge problem. That's a basic part of the competency standard. And if they didn't get that instruction, it could have messed up the whole fairness of the trial, you know?
Yeah.
It might have even violated Huggins' right to due process. So they, the dissenting judges, they really thought the trial court should have taken a closer look at exactly what the jury heard.
So even the way those instructions are delivered, whether it's spoken or written, that can become a legal issue.
Totally, yeah.
It really shows you how carefully they have to look at everything, every single word, especially in a death penalty case where the stakes are so incredibly high.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's move on to another really important part of this case, intent to kill.
Right, the mens rea.
This came up during the phase where they were figuring out if he was guilty, right?
Yes, during deliberations.
And I remember reading that the jury actually sent a question to the judge while they were deliberating.
Oh yeah, that was an interesting one.
A question that goes straight to the heart of how we define intent in the law. Like, what does it really mean to intend to kill someone? They asked if they could decide whether Huggins intended to kill the victim based on what he did after the shooting, specifically because he didn't try to help her.
It's a really good question, right?
Yeah.
Because when we talk about intent in the law, usually we're talking about what the defendant was thinking at the exact moment the crime happened.
So not what they do afterward.
Exactly. It's about that split second.
So how did the judge handle that? And what did the California Supreme Court ultimately say about it?
Well, the trial judge told the jury, basically, that they could look at Huggins's behavior after the shooting when they were trying to figure out his intent.
Yep.
And the majority on the Supreme Court, they said, you know, that might not have been totally accurate, but in light of all the other evidence, it probably didn't change the outcome. But Justice Kennard, she was not having it. She wrote another dissent, and she argued pretty strongly that this instruction was flat out wrong. She said it basically let the jury decide intent based on things that happened after the crime, which is not how it's supposed to work.
Uh-huh.
She was worried that this might have led the jury to focus on, you know, how heartless Huggins seemed after the shooting instead of what his mental state was when he actually pulled the trigger. Like, did he mean to kill her at that moment?
It's a very specific moment in time.
Yeah, and her point was, this instruction might have made it easier for the prosecution to prove intent, which is a huge deal in a murder case.
So it's not about whether he was a good guy or a bad guy afterward. It's about what was going on in his head at the moment of the crime.
Exactly. And that can be really hard to prove.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important point for anyone studying law. What someone does after a crime, it might tell you something about them, but it doesn't necessarily prove what their intentions were at the moment it happened.
Yeah, their actions afterward could be driven by fear, panic, who knows?
Right, it's a whole different situation.
The dissent was basically saying, hey, the jury might have convicted Huggins of intentional murder just because he didn't help the victim, not because they were convinced he planned to kill her. And that raises some big questions about how we understand criminal responsibility and the whole idea of intent.
Right, huge implications.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So we've talked about the competency issue and the intent issue, but didn't Huggins also make some broader arguments against the death penalty itself?
Oh, yeah, he definitely did.
Challenging the whole system.
He argued that California's death penalty was unconstitutional in how it was being applied. And, you know, these are the same kinds of arguments that come up a lot in death penalty cases.
Like what?
Stuff like cruel and unusual punishment, you know, the Eighth Amendment. And due process, the 14th Amendment, and equal protection, also the 14th. Basically, he was saying the whole system was unfair. But the Supreme Court, they followed the existing legal precedents, and they rejected those broader challenges. They said the death penalty, as it stands in California, is legal.
Okay, so we've gone pretty deep into this case, but if you had to boil it all down, what are the biggest takeaways? What should our listeners, those law students out there, really understand about the People v. Michael James Huggins.
So, I mean, the most basic outcome was that the court upheld the convictions and the death sentence, except for a small change they made to one of those enhancements for his prior convictions. But I think the real lessons are about the legal principles involved.
Yeah, that's the good stuff.
First, it's a perfect example of just how much scrutiny those jury instructions get, especially in a death penalty case. Every word, every phrase is examined under a microscope. Likely versus substantial certainty, it might seem like a small difference, but it can have a huge impact on the outcome of a trial. And it raises some serious questions about due process.
And it also shows you how important it is to get that competency standard right. It's not enough for the defendant to just sort of understand what's happening. They need to be able to meaningfully participate in their own defense, to rationally help their lawyer.
Exactly. And we have to make sure the jury understands both parts of that standard, that it's not just about comprehension, it's about being able to assist in a rational manner.
Right. Both pieces are crucial.
And then there's the whole discussion about intent, which is so tricky. The jury's question and the disagreement among the judges about whether you can consider what the defendant did after the crime, it really highlights how important it is to pinpoint the defendant's mental state at the exact moment of the crime. You know, what were they thinking when they acted? That's what matters for intent.
And their actions afterward, they might tell you something, but they're not proof of what they were thinking at that crucial moment.
Right, exactly.
And finally, I think this case shows you the role of appeals courts, especially in death penalty cases. You see this tension between the majority, who usually defer to what the trial court decided about the facts of the case, and the dissent, who are more focused on making sure the rules were followed, that the defendant's rights were protected.
And that's a really good point. It's about finding that balance between respecting the trial court's decisions and making sure everything was done fairly, especially when someone's life is on the line.
Yeah, the stakes couldn't be higher.
So, you know, for you future lawyers out there, think about this. Could the actual words used in those jury instructions, even seemingly small words, affect how a jury understands those really complex legal ideas like intent or competency?
Good question.
Those jurors, they come from all different backgrounds, and they might not be legal experts. They're relying on the judge to explain the law to them, so those instructions have to be crystal clear. No room for misunderstanding.
And for anyone thinking about criminal defense, how do you go about challenging a defendant's competency? What kind of evidence do you need? How do you deal with those ethical issues around expert testimony? And how do you convince a jury that your client might not be competent to stand trial? It's not always easy.
Right. It's a delicate balance.
And then stepping back even further, why do you think we have this automatic appeal process for death penalty cases? Why are they reviewed so carefully?
Yeah. Why are they treated differently?
What does that say about our values as a society? What does it say about how seriously we take the idea of taking a life?
Big questions.
Yeah. Those are some things to think about.
Definitely.
So as you go through law school, cases like the People v. Michael James Huggins, they really bring those textbook principles to life. They show you how messy and complicated things can get in the real world.
That's the truth.
We hope our deep dive has given you a better understanding of capital punishment, how appeals work, and just how important it is to make sure every step of the legal process is fair and accurate.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Thanks for listening.
See ya. Bye.